shame what they did to it. Now who rap just don't go that same route. But they take the rawness away. Just didn't make it too pretty.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being
held. Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
KBOO.
Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you are on earth, whether you're listening to KBOO.fm on the internet or KBOO 90.7 FM on the dial in the Portland area. This is your once monthly show, Culture in Motion. I'm your host, Mike Crenshaw. We talk about the intersection between art, culture, politics, music, and activism. And today we have a very special guest, Umia Najer, and we're going to be talking about some pretty heavy stuff. Intersections between plant medicine, sacred plant medicine, ceremonial use of plant medicine, and what some people call psychedelics, and the expansion and elevation of human consciousness. And how are you doing, Umia?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm happy to be here with you, and just excited to see what we stir up in this conversation.
Indeed, indeed. We've got, Umia and I are part of a podcast project called Race Trips, and we're co-producing it with Aaron Yankee and Selena Flores. And you all might be familiar with the It Did Happen Here podcast. So that same production team has invited Umia to join us, and we're producing Race Trips, and it will be out at some time in the near future. So hopefully some of this information will be included in the podcast. We've got an event coming up on September 15th from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Black Futures Farm. So we'll look to get that information posted on the KBOO website, and hopefully some of you guys will be there in person, because we're going to be having a live conversation, music and food in the community, and talking about these same issues. So, Mia, you and I were warming up, and there's so much we can talk about. You have so much to share. I talk a lot, so I want to, you know, do a good job of not hogging the microphone. Your poem that we talked about, maybe we could use the performance of your poetry to set the context for the rest of the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So this poem is called Angels of Celestial Migration. In the river of stars, we are tiny beings orbiting our solar nipple. The surface of our planetary life raft is ravished. We are oblivious to the magnitude of everything, yet we bear the divine imprint, and that's our innocence. Teetering between strata of consciousness, I am collapsed on the temple stone steps. The moon shines intensely on my body, which I no longer operate. In my search for the earth spirit, she is divine love, and I am her precious passenger. She presses me close to death. It's not like holding a child's hand to the fire. the lesson is of an entirely different order. She holds me there indefinitely until I remember I have been death's precious child before, inside my mother, suspended in the eternal territory. We are seamless again. In the time of surrender, I'm holding on to life. I blink but cannot tell if my eyes are open or closed. A Mandinka angel fans me with feathers from a sacred bird. I come undone. All my petals fall out. I am a sparkling waterfall. I'm in a palace of orbs, pink and glistening, like the unruptured gums of a newborn. I am free, and light years beyond where plants grow, a tiny peephole opens above my heart. Light seeps in. A song gets loose. I am on a small asteroid, a hand-carved lute, 200 moons spinning in space. This celestial palace is the dwelling place of my little sister's spirit. And mashallah, Seda is still on earth, living as some children do, caressing the earth, her little feet blackening as the worms scurry away.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me to read that and to share that.
What inspired that poem?
This poem was inspired by one of my experiences in ceremony in Mexico. And, you know, every ceremony is so incredibly profound and different. And, you know, usually I go into ceremony and I'm praying about very big questions about humanity and the trajectory of our species and what we need right now on Earth. And so this poem is an attempt to capture the entire experience from being, you know, immobile at some points, you know, and the lessons really around death, around being held, pressed so deeply into the force of death that I could remember being in that force before. And, you know, before I was born, actually, my umbilical cord was wrapped around my neck very, very tightly. And so I went back into that experience and could experience it both as myself and as my mother, because in that moment before birth, we're completely connected. We're one being and separate beings at the same time.
Wow.
And yeah, it's about all of these things. And it's about, I went to my little sister's where her spirit lives. And so this is just an attempt to capture some of that force, some of that profound, beautiful force of the medicine.
So there's quite a few things have come up from your answer. I think, you know, in a linear sense, one of the first things you said was ceremony. Some of our listeners might not know what you mean when you say ceremony. It could be a very broad and general term. So I would love it if you would touch on that. You also mentioned this experience of this non-linear experience of an awareness of where your consciousness was before you were even born into your physical body. and also being at one with your mother, yet separate in your own kind of autonomous awareness of self. That made me think about this practice called Kriya Yoga, also known as rebirthing, and how, you know, through breath work and meditation, we can actually visit the circumstances of our birth. And a lot of people aren't aware of that, you know, capacity that we have. We carry a lot of trauma from the experience of birth, especially in the Western world, where we're coming into physical being from our mother's wombs into a very violent and foreign environment that's not nurturing. So those are two things that come to mind. I don't remember the last thing that came to mind, but there's you have this kind of expansive awareness about being a human being that transcends the concept of race. So I just said a whole bunch, but I was reflecting on what you shared. Can you speak to any of those things? Like maybe, first of all, what do you mean when you say ceremony?
Yeah, so I have, through circumstances, through a messenger, been called into the path of plant medicine, grandmother medicine, and, you know, starting with really working with the indigenous stewards of the medicine. They call it Uni. And Uni is a medicine that there's a story of how it came to Earth, actually. Uni did not exist at the beginning of creation. It was brought down when a particular leader passed away. And there's two different versions of the story, but in one of them, plants grow out of where the people bury him. And the people think, well, these plants must have killed our beloved chief, our leader. So they eat the plant. And when they eat the plant, they all begin to float. And they keep walking and walking, but they're floating higher and higher until they get to the spirit realm where he is, and he's very surprised to see them. He's like, why did you come here? And they're like, well, we came looking for you, you know, we want to be with you. And he said, well, you know, you came with your feces and everything that's inside of your guts. He said, this place is for spirits. And so you need to go back to the world that we came from and that I left. But anytime that you need to speak with me, you can use these plants and I will be there.
Wow.
And so Uni is a very beautiful, very powerful plant medicine that, you know, can be used for different purposes. And one of them is connecting with the ancestors, with the spirit realm.
So Uni, is it safe to say that Uni is also commonly what people would call ayahuasca?
Yes, yes. In English, that is usually what it's called, and in other languages as well.
Ayahuasca banisteriopsis is a plant that grows. It's a vine. I've seen and held the vine. It's a very resilient, sturdy, strong, dense life form. But in order for the medicine that is part of ayahuasca, which isn't separate, the word medicine, the word ayahuasca, these aren't separate entities. And there's reasons for that. And maybe we can get more into that, but I think you're alluding to it. It's not just the vine, the ayahuasca banisteriopsis. It's a mixture of sometimes many different plants and compounds that allow for somebody to have this transformative experience of consciousness expansion. So when you said the plants grew out of the body of the leader, the people ate them and were able to have this kind of lucid experience, and then they could come back and take the medicine anytime they wanted to reach those levels of consciousness. How did people discover the different compounds from many different plants that had to be consumed in a mixture so that they could have these kinds of experience? Because if you were to just like eat, you know, like the bark or the wood from the vine of the ayahuasca plant, you're not going to necessarily have these experiences. Do you know anything about like how people discovered the...
I think that's a great question, and I can't speak to that, you know. That would be a great question for some of the indigenous stewards of the medicine.
Uh-huh.
I would suspect maybe even that there is not just one single origin, but that there are multiple origins. And, you know, the last thing I'll say to that is that when I was speaking with people in the Amazon, they speak a lot about how the plants communicate with them. And so, you know, there's at least two-way communication between plants and people.
Mm-hmm.
It could be more than that.
Yeah, we were, one of the things that we've been discussing and thinking about as part of our project is how a lot of times in Western societies, there's this extractive relationship. And so people think of what are commonly called psychedelics as something that's like, oh, you go on this mind expansive trip and it's you could get intoxicated and you get really high and it's a really wild experience. And maybe there's some spiritual aspect to it. But often in first cultures, and when I say first cultures, I'm talking about indigenous people, wherever, you know, their ethnic origin is geographically on the globe, there's often not this extraction of one property from a plant that separates that property and that plant from this more holistic relationship. So like, you know, people might be able to have ceremonial use of a plant, but then there are also other uses, like maybe that same plant can be used as a salve, or maybe it can be a healthy ingredient in cooking, you know, or maybe if it's dried and prepared a certain way, it can contribute to a sturdy building to provide shelter for people who live in the community. Do you have any reflection on like the way that we in the West tend to extrapolate aspects of plants for our specific purposes or aims, but don't really have this kind of more holistic understanding about how we relate to nature?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the origins of that go to the origins of Western thought, which is really invested in separating everything into the smallest unit and understanding things unit by unit instead of systematically. And so, you know, by virtue of like being in the West, even those of us who are not from the West originally, we can come to absorb this kind of extractive and atomizing way of relating to plants and to nature.
Mm.
I think, you know, the other thing is that if you look at the world, you know, much of the Western world, nature is not intact anymore.
Mm.
So I've heard, you know, I've heard elders, Native American elders, who say, well, you know, the trees used to speak to us a lot, but they've been very quiet. They don't speak as much as they used to.
Mm.
And I think it's really interesting and touching and yeah, we many of us are living, you know, inside of the belly of ecocide.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's not what we see. You know, we look out the window and I see some trees and I think, oh, these trees are beautiful, but these few trees are the very few that remain of the millions that were here before. And so I think that mindset is also a result of having harmed nature and the environment so much that many of us do not have an opportunity to really exist, like, fully, to fully be immersed in nature and to have that more powerful connection, that spiritual connection with all living beings.
Wow. Thank you for, you know, sharing your awareness with us. I think it's very important. I think, you know, you have a name, I have a name, we're individuals, we have identities, and when we fill out paperwork, we can probably check a few different boxes that designate what demographic we come from and how we orient ourselves to whatever system we're trying to operate in. But I think what you're shedding light on is that we have a common experience that's far deeper, far broader than a lot of what we are conditioned to focus on. I can see the physical evidence of this in my lifetime. The fracturing of communities through displacement and economic coercion, the prison industrial complex, colonialism and capitalism, and the introduction of a digital and virtual means of production through device dependency. So, like, we look at our phones to the point where we're no longer aware of our environment. So with the point you made about trees and like how there could be, you know, millions and billions of more of these entities creating this complex web in an ecological system that's interdependent with our own existence. Yet we find ourselves focused on things that are superficial constructs through the amount of time we have to spend looking at a screen. And we become separate from our environment to the point that a lot of us who live in urban environments where most of the world's population is concentrated, aren't even aware of things outside of our immediate, you know, focus. You live in, you're between California and Colorado. You know, you're working on your academic career. We met in the Amazon, but you're Sudanese. You're an African woman. So, like, what is the connection between your studies and your experience connecting with people, First People and Indigenous people in the Americas, and where you see yourself as an African person?
That's a great question. So I'm doing my PhD at Stanford in a program called Modern Thought and Literature. And it's a very kind of open-ended program. So people are studying all sorts of things. And when I came in, I knew I wanted to do Black studies. I was really interested in just studying the works and the lives of people who were descended from Africa, whether they were in the Caribbean or in South America or in Africa or in North America or in Asia. So I was deeply engaged reading about the lives of Afro-descendant people and their philosophies on life. And I was really interested always in understanding kind of a bigger picture. I'm a big picture systematic kind of thinker. And so, you know, when I began this work, modernity and the beginning of the transatlantic slave trade, which is the biggest human trafficking project on Earth to ever take place. I took that as the starting point of the modern world. And, you know, this is where colonization begins. It's where slavery begins. It's where capitalism begins. It's where even what we call the Anthropocene, which Anthropocene is a name for the geological epoch we're inside of. And it speaks to the fact that we are living in a time where the human impact on the planet is so astronomical that it's akin to that of a major geological force, such as an ice age or a comet hitting the Earth. So we are living inside of that, and all of that, the entire system of modernity, begins, you know, in the 1400s. It begins as a European world-making project. Mm. And I don't know that they thought of it as that in the beginning, you know, those early colonists who went out. But what they were doing was creating a different kind of world. And the way that I see it, you know, the project of European world building is an utter failure. That's not to say that there aren't beautiful things that have happened in the last 500 years or useful technological advances. There definitely are, but, you know, what it means is that we can't keep going on like this. Mm. That world has to be transplanted by a new world. And I believe that that new world, you know, lives inside of all of us. So for me, a lot of this work really started as trying to understand modernity and race and capitalism and how they shape our reality, because what I'm really interested in is the new world, what we're going to create moving forward from here. And to bring this back to like the medicines, I think one of the powerful things about the plant medicines is that, you know, they have the capacity to increase our sensitivity and our awareness of the interconnection of all life forms. And that comes with a shift in perspective. So we can cease to experience everything from a standpoint of a singular self or the individual unit of personhood that we're taught inside of the system of modernity. That unit dissolves, even if temporarily, and we're able to experience time and being more expansively and be inside of a polytemporal understanding of time. And so why is that a big deal? Because with the enriched sense of time comes a renewed relationship to history. And we're able to step outside of like a narrow view of time. We're able to step outside of the last 500 years, you know. And I'm thinking about the last 30,000 years of human history. Mm. So, you know, I used to be very heartbroken by the havoc of the European world building project and all of the suffering, the irrevocable loss of cultures, languages, and species, and entire ecosystems. And, you know, now my view has really shifted from a focus on the immense harm that's been created in the last 500 years to taking stock of where is our species right now, and then how do we move forward from here? And I think this is a really important question for everybody, you know, to sit down and through whatever forms, meditation, study, anything, to really see where are we now And then where are we going to go forward from here? And that work of elevating the consciousness of humanity is really, really important. And, you know, we cannot continue perpetuating our lowest natural instincts like ego and violence and othering. And part of this is that, like, I believe we're still evolving as a species. Mm. How humanity is right now, what we see now, this is not our final form. And I'm not talking about like physical kind of upgrades that we're going to get. I'm talking about an evolution in consciousness that is going to allow all of us, humans and non-humans, to live in accordance with our highest potential.
Mm. Man, you're really bringing to light so many different directions. And I want to be aware of time. You have some questions that you want to ask me as well. We agreed to a format where we were going to interview each other, but this is such.
Yeah, I know.
I'm gonna have to have you back on, Umnia, because I think this is an ongoing conversation, and we can't fit it all into an hour. But
if we have some time, I would love to ask you some questions.
Yes, I'm going to say this. I'm going to say two bars that are in alignment with everything you've expressed. And then I'm going to take questions from you.
Mm.
These two bars are: the physical is a vehicle for the soul. The individual is indivisible from the whole.
Hey. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Exactly.
That's exactly right.
So yeah, I'm yours. Shoot.
Well, so I've been really wanting to ask you about your trip to Tanzania, and I know a little bit. I know that you helped some indigenous people purchase their land back, and I would just love if you could tell us about how did this start. You know, how did you create these relationships, and what exactly were you doing when you were out there? Mm-hmm. And if you can tell us about the indigenous people you were with.
So a lot of people understand. Thank you for asking that question. A lot of people who grew up, you know, looking at documentaries about Africa on PBS, or maybe even looked at National Geographic, or were curious about the continent of Africa, might have noticed that there's a certain ethnic profiles that are common. A lot of Western exposure through media in terms of how the continent of Africa is depicted is either depicting instability and famine on one hand, conflict and war, or it's about the natural beauty and nature and the geographic wonders. And in the depiction of nature and the geographic wonders, we're often seeing certain ethnic groups or tribes. And one of those tribes is the Maasai people. Maasai are very iconic when it comes to representation of, you know, what we think of in the West as African people and African tribes people. So I've been able to go to Africa numerous times to numerous countries. My journey started in 2004. I was invited to participate in a conference on economic justice, youth empowerment, HIV/AIDS, and genocide reconciliation in Rwanda, 10 years after the 1994 genocide. So it was the 10-year anniversary of the genocide. I went with a small cohort of people from the West to a conference that was attended by roughly 70 indigenous African people from the Great Lakes region. When we think about Africa, there are different regions. There's a southern region, western region, central east, and northern. And the Great Lakes are kind of in the middle of the continent. Some of the countries surrounding the Great Lakes, just like we have Great Lakes in the United States, these are inland lakes that if you were to be on the shore and you were to try to look across, you, it would look like an ocean because you couldn't see the other side. That's how huge these lakes are. And so Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, there are people from all these countries there in Rwanda that were building coalition work around these questions of how can we support genocide survivors. At the time, I think Rwanda had the highest, proportionately the highest population of young people under the age of 35 that had been orphaned, separated from their families because of the consequences of the genocide. And so there were all these young people in the country who didn't have familial support and who had an extreme amount of trauma from watching their families slaughtered in this genocide. When I went to that conference, there's so much I could just say about that. It was a very powerful, transformative experience. It was my first time in Africa as an African descendant, you know, living in a diaspora, descendant of people who survived shadow slavery in the United States. It was important for me to go to the continent, but to connect with people. One of the conditions of my participation in the conference was that I participate in a 2-year follow-up project related to the outcomes of the conference. So at the conference, I met young people, organizers and activists, community workers in the region, not just in Rwanda, but in the Great Lakes region, who had different projects that they wanted Westerners, such as myself, to support. And some people came to me and they said, hey, we're trying to build a computer center because we want our youth to be computer literate so that they can have better opportunities to compete in the market and, you know, create jobs and careers and educational opportunities. And they asked me if I would help them channel resources from the West so that they could build a computer center in Bujumbura, Burundi, which is the neighboring country of Rwanda. So that was my, you know, these African comrades asked me, they created a project and they asked me to support them with it. It's important to note that it wasn't me being somebody from the U.S. going to the continent and saying, this is what you need. No, it was me being directed by them knowing what they needed. And so they asked for my support. I came back to the States and reached out to Free Geek, a nonprofit computer repair organization. And Free Geek donated 7 desktop computers. I reached out to Dead Prez, the hip hop group, and their message, their lyrical message through their political hip hop was in alignment with what we were trying to achieve in the project. And they came to Portland, Oregon, where I live, and they helped us raise the money through a benefit concert. And we shipped the computers to Bujumbura. Bujumbura, Burundi built 1 computer center. Then they built 2 computer centers. Then they built 3. Then they started putting in roads and bridges and doing food sovereignty projects on the land. That work, word of that work, got me invited to Zimbabwe to a music festival called the Shoko International Music Fest in 2012. And now it was when I was in Zimbabwe performing at the Shoko Music Fest that I met some comrades, Biko, Kacha. Big shout out to Briggs Bamba, who was in Rwanda, who later invited me to the Shoko Music Fest in Zimbabwe. And they were talking about a project called the African Hip Hop Caravan that toured from Cape Town to Cairo and was hosted in different cities across the continent of Africa by indigenous hip hop collectives. So when I heard them talking about it, I said, how can I be involved? This sounds like a dream come true. I want to participate. And once again, the African comrades gave me a couple of assignments. And I went back to the United States and got support. I got a handwritten letter from Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is still suffering, languishing behind bars, you know, a political prisoner. Black liberation, you know, warrior. And I got a handwritten letter in support of the African Hip Hop Caravan, amongst other things, that they asked me to do in the West. And I went back in 2013 and we started the African Hip Hop Caravan in Cape Town, South Africa, went to Johannesburg, and then we went to Harare, Zimbabwe. And then in the years that followed, we added Nairobi, Kenya, and Arusha, Tanzania to that route. In Arusha, Tanzania, I met Mama C and Pete O'Neill, who are Black Panthers, who left the United States in political exile in 1970. And initially they went to Algiers, where the Black Panthers had a diplomatic base. And eventually they wound up in Tanzania when they were expelled from Algeria. They've been in Tanzania, you know, for close to 50 years. And they've created, Mama C and Pete O'Neill have created the United African Alliance Community Center, a beautiful utopian dream in terms of Black liberation, and combining Black folks from the African diaspora, with them being political exiles from the United States, returning to the mother continent, and then supporting indigenous people on the ground and in the community with Tanzania. And hip hop was a huge part of the work that they were doing, along with the recording studio, an orphanage, a school, and many, many, many community projects. So through my time with the African Hip Hop Caravan, I wound up returning to Tanzania. It became one of my favorite places to visit. And over the years, I've developed relationships with indigenous Maasai people in Tanzania that I met through the Hip Hop Caravan. So these Maasai people are not only who we think of when we imagine the iconic images of warriors, you know, jumping vertically and you know, having spears and in a very tight relationship with their livestock, cattle as they roam their land. Good evening. Vertically, and you know, having spears, and in a very tight relationship with their livestock, cattle as they roam their lands, but they're also hip hop artists and community organizers and educators and poets and beat makers and singers and songwriters. And so through the caravan, I became close with a number of Maasai artists. And eventually some of them said, hey, again, this is the third iteration. Hey, Crenshaw, can you help us develop some projects? Because we don't have access to the finances that you do in the West. And because of climate change and ongoing drought, the water sources that our people depend on, the children depend on, are squalid. There's less water. The livestock, the wild animals, and the humans are all drinking from the same water source, and there's less water. People are getting sick. So we started to put our heads together about how to get access to more potable water, healthier drinking water. And then that expanded into food sovereignty. Like, how can we, you know, support these people growing their own food? And then that expanded into Tanzania's biggest, you know, gross domestic product, which is the safari business. People come from all over the world to look at the animals. And a lot of the people that are making the money off of that aren't actually Tanzanian people. So I'm helping Maasai folk that I'm comrades with develop projects for clean drinking water, food sovereignty, and indigenous ownership of ecotourism. And yeah, so I just went over there a few weeks ago in June, late June into July, to look at some of the land that we helped Maasai brother by the name of Kila Reedy Maasai, who has a couple of NGOs that he started, non-government organizations, to support, you know, his community. We helped him purchase some land, and it's a beautiful couple of parcels of land right on the rim of Ngorongoro Crater, which is an international tourist destination for wildlife and safari. So yeah, I think this is a long-term project. You know, I'll continue to help support the development of the project, but ultimately my dream, Nia, is to take groups of people from the United States, Africans in the diaspora, and youth to go see and have cultural exchange, you know, with indigenous African people, and understand that we have a place that, just like this, you know, the foundation of the United States of America has this mythology of, you know, we welcome all the hungry, the tired, the poor, and the weary, and these immigrants. But there's this kind of missing thing about this displaced, stolen class of people, and often the indigenous and first people are left out. So there's a bridge that we have to build between forcibly displaced Africans in the diaspora and indigenous Africans at home on the continent. And that's, you know, really what underlies this work.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So amazing, Mike. Like, one of the things that really strikes me is just how you've been in community with folks and moving around and, you know, not kind of falling into this illusion of like separation, that is really powerful or can be powerful. Yeah, it's really, really amazing to hear how you've just been building community with folks for so long. And this project sounds wonderful, as does the one of bringing youth and, you know, Black people from the United States and maybe from other parts of, you know, the world, maybe Brazil, maybe, you know, I'm imagining it even bigger already, bringing people to the continent to have those exchanges and experiences.
Yes, it's thank you for noting, you know, this is the term that comes to mind right now is universal or even colossal. But in the context of Pan-African consciousness, right? We understand that, you know, in terms of the history of the archaeological history of the human race that we can trace, that not basically through Western systems of thought, right? Because those have become dominant in recent history. But we understand that we have older systems of thought and record keeping that are part of First Peoples oral traditions, right? And so there's part of the story about humankind that precedes what we think of as conventional historical narratives, right? And so our future is tied to our past, and I'm curious about what we can achieve if we have a deeper understanding of who we are beyond this colonial, imperial, capitalist, patriarchal, militaristic, extractive project.
Yes.
You know, we can, go ahead.
Well, I think so much of that project is about disconnecting us not only from our roots, but also from ourselves. And, you know, I don't mean that so abstractly. I mean from our internal sense of autonomy, of, you know, that includes everything from autonomy of movement and the capacity to go and engage actively in the world, to the autonomy of thought and understanding, even beginning the quest to understand, why are we here? How do I feel about, you know, life on planet Earth right now? And then what do I want to do about that? These really, really basic, and these are just the basic building blocks of autonomy. It gets a lot deeper from there. But just starting from that, you know, this is what the entire system is created to disconnect us from. So that, you know, you are not in your power, and so that you believe that you can choose somebody else to represent you. So for me, I think political representation is like one of the biggest shams out there, because there is nobody in this world who can represent me. Why is that? Because I am awake. I am alert. There's no other me. There's nobody I can give permission to make a decision on my behalf. And so... Yeah, so when we reclaim that sense of autonomy, we become extremely powerful. And the system that we're living in ceases to have any power over us. When we say, I cannot be represented, I represent myself, I am autonomous.
Imagine the power, and we, history, you know, Haiti, for instance, to this day, suffering under foreign orchestration of coups, economic coercion, economic violence, but all as retaliation for being the first country that was liberated by forcibly displaced Africans in the Western Hemisphere. We have our right to autonomy, to rediscovering our capacity and potential and our powerful nature as individuals who are in touch with things beyond the consumer capitalist construct. But imagine what we can do if we work with that awareness, with that empowerment, collectively, collaboratively, in solidarity and in coalition, as a people rising. Imagine if that, the rising of the people, is not something that is solely oriented to race, ethnicity, gender, class, or national orientation, but something that is connected to our species as humans, reclaiming our connection to the abundance of the planet Earth, and understanding that as we step into that power, that we are interdependent on all other species that we coexist on the planet with, and that mass extinction of other species ensures the extinction of our own species. So that's the question that I'm looking at, and I think you are too, is how do we be more accountable for the role that we play as human beings?
And how do we become the world builders? You know, because we are at the precipice between a world that is ending and a world that has yet to be born. And we are the doulas of a new world order.
Yes.
We have to imagine it. We have to create it. And for me, you know, the way to create it is very experimental. You know, there's no blueprint for how we're going to get to the new world. And I don't think there should be a blueprint necessarily. We have to arrive there somewhat organically and experimentally. And so this is also part of why these experiences of cultural exchange, whether it's, you know, your work with the Maasai in Tanzania or in Uganda, or, you know, going to the Amazon rainforest and connecting human to human, connecting across cultural divides. And it means letting go of some of the mass projections that modernity has fed us, and all of the identity groupings fall into that. And it's not to say that though they're imagined, right? Race is very real, and racism is very real, and gender is very real, and gender violence is very real. Those are just two examples. But if we get caught up in understanding ourselves through these categorical constructs, we are just going to have a experience that is cyclically reinforcing the experience of existence that continues to uphold the illusions of modernity. And in that way, we get stuck in a cycle. So I think part of getting free is freeing ourselves from all of these notions and categories, laying that all down, and very humbly allowing ourselves to ask, what does it mean to be human? What does that mean to me? Let alone, what does that mean for all of humanity?
Man.
And yeah, and you know, one of the things Nishiwaka said, Nishiwaka is the chief of the Yawanawa tribe in the Acre region of Brazil, and he said, we need to arrive at a new concept of the human. He's not the first one to say this. You know, Black feminist scholars have also said this. People like Sylvia Winter. It's very, very crucial, because the story that we are being told by the system that wants to oppress all of us for the gain of just a few is always going to feed us a story about what it means to be human that is going to uphold our oppression. And they're also going to keep telling us that where we are right now in the trajectory of our species is a product of linear progression. That this is a kind of progress narrative where we've been progressing, and this is progress, right? But if right, yeah, so we have to think for ourselves and arrive at new concepts that will liberate us and liberate all beings on this planet. Harmony is completely within our reach, but it's not automatic. We have to work for it, and we have to uphold it.
Indeed. I want to thank you for joining us on Culture in Motion. You're going to be in town in the coming weeks. There's an event at Black Futures Farm, 6745 Southeast 50th Street, Portland, Oregon. And that's going to be September 15th, 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. A couple of groups, Portland Psychedelic Society, BIPOC Integration Circle, as well as the House of Jasiri. And a very special guest, Naomi Karongo from Kenya. And Umnia, you're going to be there. The cast of and producers of Race Trips podcast is going to be there. So thank you for joining us, and we hope to see some of y'all out there in a couple of weeks. And have a good night, Umnia.
Thank you, Mike. This was so wonderful.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a full-time development director. This position leads all fundraising campaigns in alignment with KBOO's mission, goals, and policies. The development director works closely with management and staff to identify funding priorities and create major donor campaigns, capital campaigns, and grant writing. More info can be found at kboo.fm/hiring. We will begin reviewing applications on August 7th, and the position will remain open until filled. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer.
Hey, how's it going out there? KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM here in Portland, Oregon. Hello in Philo.